Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young. We start today in school cafeterias around Massachusetts, where families and school officials are bracing for the worst. Tomorrow is the last day that any child, regardless of income, will be able to eat lunch for free at school. That pandemic-era measure is expiring after Congress failed to renew it. Locally, there are efforts in Massachusetts to extend the program for the entire next school year, but that provision is also tied up in negotiations on Beacon Hill as lawmakers work to finalize the state budget for the fiscal year that begins on Friday. According to the organization Project Bread, every school district in Massachusetts participated in the pandemic-era federal program, and if it ends, as many as 400,000 children would be without meals at school. Here to talk more about what the program means for their students is Keith Lavoie, Assistant Superintendent of Operations at Northborough and Southborough Public Schools, and Sarah Littman, Director of Food and Nutrition Services at Triton Regional School District, serving Newbury, Rowley, and Salisbury, Massachusetts. Sarah, Keith, welcome.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, I want to start with a question for both of you, and that's what's at stake here. Sarah, I'll start with you.
There's a lot at stake. Our students have been provided with their meals for free for the last 2 years. And going forward, we are very unsure of what's going to happen. It is tied up in the state right now. We're really hoping that the budget will be able to provide meals for our students. But it's scary to think where we're going to go from here. These students they've had these free meals. They've been getting the nutrition they've needed to be good students. And it's scary to think that's going to be taken away based on a family's income.
That's a really good point, Sarah. Keith, what about you? What do you think is at stake here?
Well, really, when we think of the pandemic, one of the silver linings of it has been the universal free meal program that everyone in the state has been able to benefit from. And I think with this now being revoked, we're putting some barriers back in place that were drawn down with universal free meals. So, we're getting back into a position of really looking at an individual family's means to be able to provide or send their child to school with or without a meal. And that outreach and being a family that would have to put their name and their income on an application is just a very uncomfortable position. So we've had the benefit for 2 years of not having that pressure, where we've then been able to really focus on the meals that we've been able to provide and the menuing and focusing on the kids versus worrying about, where the fee was going to come from. So putting back those barriers is absolutely the thing that I'm most worried about and that we've been preparing for now for over 3 months.
So it is important to distinguish something right at the top, too. For a long time, there has been a national free or reduced meals program that operates in schools. It's run by the USDA, and that gives free breakfast and lunch to qualifying low-income students. The program we're talking about today is different than that initiative. Sarah, can you take a second to explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. So due to the pandemic, there have been waivers put in place to allow all students, regardless of income, to be provided with free breakfast and free lunch every day. And it really has shown, significant, just amazing things for our students. It's leveled the playing field. It allows all of our students to have the same access to food without having to worry about how much money is in their account. And, we've seen this. New York City has been providing free meals for over 10 years to all their students. And the research really has shown that it increases academic achievement, it lowers occurrences of bullying, and just more overall sense of community in the school district. So these students have been coming into school every day for the last 2 years, getting free food. And it's been pretty incredible to see, the sense of community, even just in our cafeterias.
Well, I want to follow up with this too. Knowing that there was that USDA program that's been around for a while for qualifying students, and we had this COVID era policy, why do we need the universal policy, no matter what your income is? Isn't that kind of repeating efforts?
honestly, the way the world has been the last few years, even the last few months, we've seen significant increases in food costs. And we've seen that at our level, you know, as a school district providing food at a, you know, a high, we're putting out, you know, 2,000 meals a day. And so our food costs have gone up significantly. But think about the families. You go into the grocery store, you're seeing the food costs being significantly increased, and access to food has been taken away due to supply chain and also the war. And so now going forward, these families who have been really relying on school meals to provide nutrition for their kids, that's going to increase their costs now in addition to what they're already having to feel when they go to the grocery store.
I want to ask a question about need to Keith next. Your district has roughly 4,000 total students. What are you seeing right now, or, you know, later on in the spring semester? What were you seeing for the need for free and reduced meals then?
You know, that's one of the question marks that we have, because we haven't had to process those applications or review the level of need with families. It has been universally free. So we really don't know what to anticipate as far as the fall is concerned. And that's one of the variables that we're trying to weigh as we plan. What we did see, though, is that through other types of programming throughout the district, that there were families that were reaching out that were in need of support. And we were really directing them towards Project Bread or other types of subsidy programs to, you know, get them the things that they needed. And it went beyond the walls of the school. It was for their family. And like Sarah mentioned, you know, even going to the grocery store now can be a daunting exercise that no one is exempt from. So when we really look at this and what we know we're going to be encountering in the fall, we are predicting a high level of need, and also the administrative staff to process hundreds and hundreds of applications where these families have to, you know, put their income down on an application. I just think that is a very uncomfortable thing to ask any family, especially when we're talking about getting them a meal at school. So, you know, we've really partnered with Project Bread, really would like to see this legislation pass and the budget gap be mitigated so that we can continue the universal free programs to eliminate that barrier.
And Keith, can you talk a little bit more about how you're talking to the parents about the possibility of this pandemic era program ending and what it would mean for them?
Well, first of all, we've tried to have a high level of transparency with our school committees. Our district is regionalized, so we have three school committees, and we have tried to keep them abreast of the changes and the legislative updates that have been coming out periodically. So we have been in contact with them. We have sent multiple communications to our families indicating that the universal free lunch program was expiring on June 30th, and that would be returning to a paid program starting at the start of school on August 31st. So we did send out that communication to all families, and we do anticipate doing that again over the course of the summer so that there are no surprises for the start of school. But we still have our fingers crossed, as I'm sure Sarah does, that the legislature will come through and that the universal free meals will be continued.
Keith, you mentioned Project Bread, and we did speak with Erin McAleer, the president and CEO of the organization. She is advocating in Massachusetts to not only extend this program through next school year, but to eventually make it permanent. And she says the benefits of this program go beyond food.
We know that when kids eat free at school, when they have full bellies, they are more likely to learn, they have less health consequences, better long-term economic outcomes. And we feel meals are just as important as a quality teacher and a textbook and a desk. You know, making sure kids are fed is essential to their learning.
Keith, as a school leader, do you agree with this? What ripple effects does feeding students have on them?
Oh, absolutely. I 100% agree. You know, it's been one of those things where we saw the immediate benefit, especially of our, you know, grab and go breakfast programs where our kids could start the day with a nutritious meal, even if it was in a grab and go scenario. That really benefited us. We could see it. We saw behaviors improve. just the overall ability to learn and available for learning was increased due to the ability to give our students their free meals. It's one of the needs that needs to be taken care of regardless before they're available for learning. So as much as we can do to take care of that, we're going to see a ripple effect of benefits. And I would say even during the pandemic, with all the other stresses that it produced, this was the one stress that was eliminated, and that we saw, 20 to 25% increase in participation on a daily basis. So we saw that have a ripple effect. And I can only imagine that if it were to continue and we can focus on our menuing versus collection of money, you were just going to see this grow exponentially. And that is our hope and our expectation.
Well, and then Sarah, I want to turn to you. What would it mean for your department and your district if this program were to lapse?
It's going to be a very interesting transition. You know, I'm a registered dietitian and I advocate for child nutrition. You can't look at a child and know how much money their family makes or when their last meal was, or even their last meal that met, all the recommended servings of vitamins or minerals. Being in a food nutrition program, there are federal guidelines in place for the meals that we're serving. And so we are providing these vitamins and minerals through our food, this nutritious food that we're providing for our students at no cost. And I'm nervous that if students are going to have to go back to paying, that now the responsibility is going to be on the families for providing, not only the food cost, but the quality of food. And so with nutrition education slowly coming up, I'm nervous to see the impact, the negative impact it's going to have on students and their growth.
And then last question, Sarah, as we wait for Beacon Hill lawmakers to act, what are you thinking about? What are you hoping for?
I'm hoping for a home run. When someone asks me if meals are going to be free next year, I've been very optimistic that the Massachusetts legislators will do the right thing. And while this needs to be a permanent solution, at least to extend into the budget for next year, that meals will be free. We're coming down to the wire here. And, back in I believe it was March, the government decided to not include this in the bill. And so there are states in the country who have been preparing for this for months that, meals will not be free next year. But Massachusetts, we have the opportunity. And so I've really been optimistic and proud to be from Massachusetts to say that this option is available to our students and that the conference committee will decide that it will be in the budget for next year.
That's Sarah Littman, Director of Food and Nutrition Services at Triton Regional School District, serving Newbury, Rowley, and Salisbury, Massachusetts, and Keith Lavoie, Assistant Superintendent of Operations at Northborough and Southborough Public Schools. Keith, Sarah, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Food insecurity increased during the pandemic, and not just in classrooms. According to recent data from the Greater Boston Food Bank, 1 in 3 adults in Massachusetts are food insecure. We spoke with advocates about this data earlier this month. One farm in Concord is working to decrease that number by growing their own vegetables and distributing that produce to local food pantries and soup kitchens. With me now is Jennifer Johnson, the executive director of that farm, which is called Gaining Ground. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, good morning, Carrie. Thanks so much for having me.
So can you set the scene for us on your farm right now? What does it look like? What are you growing and distributing this week?
Yeah, absolutely. So today in the Boston area, it happens to be a brilliantly beautiful summer day, blue skies, and so things are hopping at the farm right now. We grow about 40 to 50 different varieties of fruits and vegetables, and things are totally popping at this point. Kale, spinach, carrots, you name it.
That sounds delicious. Well, I'm wondering, too, is there an easy way to describe how your farm works and what operations are like there now?
Sure. So Gaining Ground, we're in our 27th growing season, and we are a sustainable farm that grows organic produce, fruits and vegetables, and gives it all away for free to people who are experiencing food insecurity. We do this by working with hunger relief partners throughout the area. And we also do it with lots of helping hands. We have about 2,500 volunteers who come and work and learn with us on the farm each year.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the seasons and how that impacts your organization and operations?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So we're in New England, which means that we are dealing with the weather in this part of the country. And we generally start our first seeding of the year in our greenhouse in February. And we have different structures on the farm, greenhouses. Some are heated, most are not, that actually allow us to get crops into the ground a little bit earlier than certainly most home gardeners and other farms. And it used to be that Gaining Ground would just distribute its food between April and November. But in 2020, we sort of always had known that hunger is not seasonal. And in fact, if anything, there's more food insecurity in the winter months when local farms are not having surplus. So we made a concerted effort to actually begin growing in our unheated there are structures that are called hoop houses, and we are now distributing food during 12 months of the year. Those winter crops that we grow would be a kale mix, some spinach, carrots. We're certainly not able to grow the variety that we can grow in the summer and not the volume, but we're doing this to help make a dent in food insecurity. And in fact, last year we grew and distributed about 100,000 pounds of food and gave it all away to people who are experiencing food insecurity.
So one of the first questions that came to my mind when I heard about you guys was, why grow your own food to combat food insecurity? It almost seems like that would be a little bit more work than getting donations, of fresh veggies from grocery stores or other distributors.
Yeah. So, that's a great question. And I know that this program has been spending a lot of time on food insecurity lately. You've had several guests talking about it. It's a systemic problem which requires a systemic solution. And at Gaining Ground, one of the things that we have is access to this unbelievable piece of land. And the farming know-how, we're now in our 27th growing season. And so we have decided to sort of lean into our wheelhouse, which is growing an incredible amount of food on a very small footprint of land. We're cultivating currently about 3.5 acres of land and producing, like I said, over 100,000 pounds of food per year. And we see that as our role in the larger structure of being able to have an impact on this larger problem.
Great. Okay, Jennifer, I want you to hang out with us, but I do want to bring in another voice to the conversation. Tom McGowan is a volunteer on the board of directors with the Sudbury Community Food Pantry, which gets produce from Gaining Ground. Tom, nice to have you here.
Happy to be here.
So how long has the pantry been working with Gaining Ground, and why did you want to partner with them?
We've been working with Gaining Ground for roughly the last 2 years. Why would we want to partner with them? Because produce and fresh produce is one of the things our clients, the families who come to us, really need and can't afford. The two items that are most expensive, not only for them but for all of us, okay, is meat and fresh produce. We feed roughly 100 families per week. I don't even know how we started with Gaining Ground. The wonderful thing is the relationship has been very strong. I've actually done pickups there myself. The farm is beautiful. The process, they pick in the morning, okay? They rinse and repack it. And by 10 o'clock or 10:15 exactly, we pick it up from them, bring it back to the pantry, break it down, depending on the assortment of produce, the mix of that day, and then have it available for our clients by noontime. This is the freshest, out-of-the-ground, best-looking produce. You can't find it anywhere better.
Well, Jennifer did mention lots of different yummy, delicious vegetables that are growing this summer there. What types of food are really popular right now in your distribution, would you say?
In our distribution, just because of the kind of COVID-sensitive model we have, and because the produce, the mix changes, okay, every week, we put a mix available, okay, to all of our clients. So I would love to say in our old model, which was a shopping model, we could allow people to say, okay, I want more bok choy or I want more lettuce or or sweet garlic, okay? But now we give them a mix, okay? And once again, we're covering a lot of different ethnic groups, and I wish we could say we could let them, but we've got to be safe at the same time.
Now, the pantry was founded in 1990 in response to the recession at that time.
Correct.
Right now, we're exiting a global pandemic, arguably another time of uncertainty, but I'm wondering if you can talk about the need that you're seeing for food right now.
Yeah, it is continuing to grow. Year over year, last year to this year, our growth in clients has gone up by 27%. And when I say a client is one entire family, okay? From pre-pandemic times, we're up over 68%, okay?
Wow.
We've got to be more streamlined than we ever were before, and we've got to be more sensitive because we don't know when the next variant of COVID is coming. So the need is there, and it is continually growing.
Well, Jennifer, jumping off of that, Jennifer is still with us, the executive director of Gaining Ground. And listening to Tom talk about this need for food, are you seeing similar need across other partner organizations?
Absolutely, 100%. In fact, you know, we have a waiting list of people who have approached us asking for our produce. And unfortunately, there's more demand right now than we can actually give. But I wanted to just jump a little bit on what you had asked Tom about the choice and things that are popular. And one of the things that Gaining Ground does is we are in conversation with our partners throughout the year about the types of produce that their clients like, that are requested. And in addition to the more common vegetables that I mentioned, the, you know, the carrots, the lettuce, the spinach, we grow a lot of specialty crops as well. And these are one of the things that our hunger relief partners really appreciate is that, you know, they are never going to get donations of, you know, fennel or fresh herbs or some of the, you know, more specialty, you know, radishes that are actually very much requested by a lot of their population. And we are responsive. We're growing specifically what they ask for. You know, granted, we can't grow bananas or pineapples. You know, we are limited to the climate that we're in. But to the extent that we can, we're growing specifically what's requested by our clients.
And then quickly, Jennifer, if people want to help with food insecurity with this issue, how can they?
Yeah, so that's great. The first thing that I want to mention is, you know, we've been talking about these rise in food insecurity. And so if people who are listening, if they're experiencing that themselves, highly encourage you to look at resources like Project Bread to make sure that you can get the help that you might need. We would love for folks to come out and volunteer with us on the farm. A way to, you know, really physically have a hand in growing food and distributing it to people who are in need.
Great. And Tom, what would you say if people want to help? How can they?
Donations are wonderful. Okay. And go to our website, Sudbury Community Food Pantry, or to our Facebook page. We are totally a volunteer organization from top to bottom. We're volunteering our time, but we need money too, okay? And that comes in from everybody out there.
That was Tom McGowan, a volunteer, and he's on the board of directors with the Sudbury Community Food Pantry, and Jennifer Johnson, executive director of Gaining Ground. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, two friends on a mission to run a 5K in each of Massachusetts' 351 towns. I'm Carrie Young. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young. It was the summer of 2021. Karen Pyre of Leicester got an idea. Karen is a runner, and she thought, what if I could run a 5K, which is a little bit more than 3 miles, in each of Massachusetts' 351 towns? And what if I could do that in 351 days? An audacious mission, arguably. In case you need some help with the math here, that's 1,090 miles in less than a year, 3 miles a day. And that's in the dead of winter and in the height of summer, all of it. Karen also enlisted a friend on this journey, fellow runner Scott Schaefer Duffy of Worcester, and together they've made a dent in this crazy goal. So far, the duo has run more than 200 5Ks, well on track to finish their mission ahead of time. Karen and Scott are with us in studio right now to tell us a little bit more about their project. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you.
So, Karen, we're going to start with you. What inspired you to want to do this project? What was that aha moment like?
I guess it begins with, I always wondered, there's so many towns in the state that I never knew about. And a year ago, we were at our Central Mass Striders banquet, and so it's the end of COVID, and one of the girls was saying that her project for during COVID was to run a town in every state, in her state of Rhode Island. And I was like, ding, that sounds good. That sounds like an interesting way to learn, you know, all the states. And so I slowly planted seeds because he was not on board with it because I needed somebody crazy enough to do it with me. And I knew he'd be the only one. So I just started planting little seeds along the way until he finally agreed.
Okay, so Scott, what convinced you? And I guess, what did you think first when Karen asked you about this?
Well, we ran every street in the city of Worcester, which sounded like a great idea and proved to be a true nightmare. And so when she came up with another idea, as soon as she opened her mouth, I said no. And I said no over and over. And then the idea of running at dawn on Halloween in Salem struck me as, well, that would be kind of fun, kind of interesting. And then she just dragged me into the rest of it.
And Scott, you mentioned Salem. That was where this project started, I hear. So tell me, how did that first run go?
Well, it was fun. We saw people in costumes. I took a nice picture of Karen with a pirate and two witches. I titled it Three Witches and a Pirate. We ran Swampscott and
Marblehead that day.
Marblehead, you know, so we got to see where light dawns, you know, in Marblehead.
Karen, I want you to break down some of the math for me, or at least just the way you strategized this. How do you map it out? How do you decide where to go? Are you following a road or just sort of circling out? How does that work?
Generally, and we don't do like one a day. It's an average of seven a week, because if we're going to travel, you know, 2 hours, we're going to hit five towns while we're there. The route in the town, and so where the towns we might be going to is like, how much time do we have to travel that day? What's the weather going to be like? It might be different in the western part of the state versus the eastern part of the state. We might get different weather. Once we're picked down to a town, then I'm looking for landmarks, interesting things to run by in that town, and what I can squeeze into a 3-mile route. I try to find the most interesting things to, while we're there, might as well see something.
Might as well make it have something to look at while you're there. That makes sense. Well, so there are, getting to some towns might pose some unique challenges. I know what comes to mind first is Martha's Vineyard. You've got to take a ferry to get there. So, Scott, how do you guys plan for those?
Well, I have a friend on Cape Cod who has a trailer that he is going to loan us, so we can go out and do Nantucket, which is a 3-hour ferry, one town, come back, and then we can do, some of Martha's Vineyard. We're going to be doing Gosnold on Sunday, which is Cuttyhunk, the last island in a chain, and it's the only public island. And, you know, at first I thought you had to call this guy named Bob to get the ferry out there, and, you know, so that's going to be quite a little bit of a production. And in many of the towns, Karen will pick a route, and then I'll just see these incredible hills. And she said, well, yeah, it all looks flat to me on the map. And I say, when a road is called hilltop or summit, that's an indication.
It should tell you something.
Yes, yes.
But there's a tower. If there's a tower, that's something to see.
So that's a great segue to my next question, too. I mean, what are some of the favorite places that you've encountered, since you do make it a point to see something when you're at each of these locations?
One of the big ones I keep saying is, and if we can time them with the timing, and so Concord to Lexington. We ran the trail from Conking to Lexington. We did it the day after the anniversary of the battle. So try to sometimes coordinate. So that was really interesting to have done that. Bashbish Falls that we did was the tallest waterfall in the state. That was really beautiful. Unfortunately, they have it quarantined that you can't go down to the bottom anymore because they've had so many accidents there. But yeah, there's a lot of really so beautiful places and interesting historical places.
Scott, what are some of your favorite places?
Well, I like the Dr. Seuss Park in Springfield. I consider him my doctor, so I enjoyed that. And I like the Winnie the Pooh little memorial somebody put in their yard. Where was that?
That was in Westford. And that was
in Westford.
Just a side note on that. Our running personas are Pooh and Piglet. So that was a place we had to, and it was accidental that we found it, you know?
Yeah, some of the places have been surprising. We were quite surprised in Arlington. We weren't looking for it to run into the statue of the man who ultimately became Uncle Sam. You know, we didn't know that was, I didn't know that was a real person. And, you know, he wrote U.S. on his packages and people thought it was the United States. So we ran into Annie Sullivan's statue out of the blue in
Feeding Hills.
And Feeding, which is a section of Agawam. But so it in a lot of ways it's been educational, and we've met also some wonderful and helpful people too.
So I can imagine if you're seeing all of these different things that you're probably documenting it, taking a picture. So how's your selfie game? Karen, we'll start with you. Any, like, tips or things you think about when you are, you know, taking a picture?
Oh, well, we're technology-deficient people. We don't have cell phones. We don't have smartphones. We have an old-fashioned digital camera. So Scott does all the selfie taking because I can't do it. Because on those cameras, you can't see what you're taking a picture of. You just have to shoot it and guess what's going to come out. So he does all the selfies, and yeah, it's all those landmarks that we're running by in the town. Or if there's a sign, there's a rock and it has a sign on it. I said, oh, we have to stop and take a picture of this rock. There's a sign on it. Must be something important.
Well, Scott, I want to ask you first, what has your favorite run been?
Well, that's interesting because I consider favorite run sort of an oxymoron because running is always hard, in my opinion, but I really enjoyed Gloucester. Gloucester was quite, you know, my wife and I honeymooned there, and I enjoyed Gloucester. It was beautiful. They that go down to the sea in ships, the Hammond Castle. There are, you know, some cool things in Gloucester. That was a lot of fun. But each of them has their issues. We've run in the pitch dark early in the morning. We've run in the snow. We've run in the rain. Whenever Karen falls, she's fallen twice. I always make sure, don't get up so I can get a picture.
Yes, you know, he's the one with depth perception and balance issues, and I'm the one that always falls.
Yeah, erotic.
So you are taking pictures, maybe not with
yes.
a smartphone. Do you guys have fans that follow you?
No, we're not on Facebook.
Oh, right. Okay.
We've published, well, we have 4 books that we've done of the project, and we'll put them up in PDFs and give them to anybody that wants them. And, you know, we've taken pictures of people that have given us directions, a police officer that stopped Karen for speeding, and it was nice enough to give her a warning, so we call her Officer Friendly. And, you know, one of the towns we went to, there was trails around a quarry, and there were signs at the entrance, no swimming, no diving, no drinking, no boom boxes, and we found everything
going
on there.
Yeah, they had it all.
That was its own spot. Everybody coming through in and out had a towel over their shoulder.
Well, Karen, since you started this, do you have an idea of what you're going to do to celebrate when you finish?
No, there's no plan. I'll just be glad that we're done because I must admit this was a little bit more, I bit off more than I could chew on this one. The traveling is really tough.
I can imagine your car has seen a lot of miles.
Yeah.
Scott, what about you? Do you have any celebration planned?
Oh, I to say I'm impatient is to put it mildly, because this takes up a lot of our time. My wife is a long distance runner too, and she's come with us for several of the runs, but she rolls her eyes at the idea of this project. My brother is meeting with us, and tomorrow we're running six towns in Western Mass, and he's meeting us for the sum of the thing. But I think people that dip into it a little while realize why they're not doing it.
Do you think Karen can recruit you for another crazy running idea?
Oh, no. I already told him if I come up with anything else, say no. Don't let me talk him into it.
Definitely no. No. And you mentioned the car rides. I mean, those car rides, you know, we've run out of things to talk about. So it's like, are we there yet?
No.
What about now?
No.
What about now?
Not yet.
Well, thank you for joining us. That was Karen Pyre and Scott Schaefer Duffy, two friends and members of the Central Mass Striders Running Club, who are on a mission to run a 5K in all of Massachusetts' 351 towns. Karen, Scott, so fun to have you in studio with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That day, for no particular reason, I decided to go for a little run. So I ran to the end of the road, and when I got there, I thought maybe I'd run to the end of town.
President Carter, suffering from heat exhaustion, fell into the arms
of... And when I got there, I thought maybe I'd just run across Greenbow County. And I figured since I run this far, maybe I'd just run across the great state of Alabama.
That, of course, is Tom Hanks in the 1994 film Forrest Gump. It is a beautiful day today for a run and for our regular segment, Be Well, where we focus on your wellness and ours, and we're talking about running. We'd love to hear from you, too, on Twitter or through text message. You can tweet us at Radio Boston, or if you're in our texting group, you can text us at 617-766-0382. Again, that's 617-766-0382. But here to talk more about running as a sport, running for fitness, and for fun is Dr. Adam Tenforti, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and medical director at the Spalding National Running Center. Welcome, Dr. Tenforti.
Thanks for having me.
So we've invited you here as part of our wellness series. And can you start by telling us what running does for wellness inside the body and also inside the mind?
Absolutely. So I look at running as a really great sport because it does allow for overall physical activity that can be helpful for the heart, the lungs, for muscle, bone strength, but it also can be extremely helpful for stress relief and for overall mental health and wellness.
So I want to hit the ground running, if you will. We have gotten a lot of listener feedback about running and about this segment, and a lot of the questions center around how to get started. So I'm going to start with a couple of rapid-fire questions for you. And one of the members of our texting group, Cheyenneca, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, in Maynard, asks, what are the best running routes for a novice?
So I think the first thing is that running can be enjoyed by a majority of Americans. And if you're not used to doing the sport or you have any health concerns, just talking with your regular doctor to make sure there aren't any other medical issues that need to be considered as you introduce a new form of physical activity. In terms of routes, I really think it's nice to start with areas that might be a small loop so that if you are feeling overly fatigued, you have an opportunity to take some recovery. Nice even surfaces, scenic areas. A lot of people like to run outside, but making sure that it's a safe area where you're not at risk for motor vehicles getting in the way of where you're running, where you have good visibility, and then wearing clothes that make you visible, particularly if you're running at times that are darker during the year.
So we have another listener question from Will in Cambridge, and that is, what is the second wind, technically?
Second wind. So a lot of individuals will describe when they first start running that it can be extremely fatiguing. And sometimes we see these paradoxical responses where after the body becomes more adapted to running, they actually find that they feel a lot better as they continue to run. So that oftentimes can be a stumbling block for individuals who are not used to running, where they may feel very fatigued, their muscles might feel achy and sore, or they may feel out of breath, and to recognize that if you give yourself a little bit more time to adapt, sometimes people will have this second wind phenomenon where they actually start to feel better the longer they go.
Okay, and also we heard from Heather in Somerville, who says she is 40 years old, and she texted us to say that, you know, she's started up running again after a six-year hiatus and ankle surgery, but she feels like her whole life she can only make it 8 months or so before being sidelined by an injury. So how would you recommend that people would avoid injury, or what should people be looking out for when it comes to pain and injury while running?
So first off, I'm very sorry to hear of this listener's experience. We sometimes encounter this with individuals who are recovering from an initial injury, and as they return back to the sport, if they haven't addressed the mechanical deficits at that area of their first injury, their ankle, they may start to have knee pain or other parts of their body that start to hurt. And so that certainly would be a time in which I'd recommend, seeing a running medicine specialist like myself or someone within the system, the Mass General Brigham system, sports medicine system that I'm part of, where we really like to take a comprehensive approach to looking at individuals with running-related injuries. And looking at those impairments is something that shouldn't be given the blanket statement, well, if it hurts, don't do it, because that oftentimes becomes a barrier for people continuing to enjoy a sport that can be safe. In terms of those that start to get into running, understanding what is good pain versus bad pain can be a little bit of a challenge. In general, we believe that if the pain is mild, you know, pain kind of in that 0 to 2 out of 10 scale, if that pain improves with physical activity and is getting better as someone continues to advance the amount of running they do, it should not necessarily be a cause for concern. We do recommend taking some precautions if pain is getting progressively worse during a run, because that could represent a more serious injury, such as a bone injury, or perhaps could be a sign that there's an underlying injury that needs to be addressed first before continuing to advance running. Or if someone is running in a way in which they feel they're compensating, for example, they're starting to feel their other knee hurts because they feel like they're leaning a little bit differently on their affected side.
Well, I want to jump in here actually quickly and ask you, while we have time, to talk a little bit more about the mental health benefits of running and this type of aerobic exercise. What's going on inside the brain?
It's a really good question. A lot of runners will describe a phenomenon known as a runner's high, and we don't exactly know why that happens. It's actually been postulated, though, that there's a number of neurochemicals oftentimes that overlap with some of the signals associated with managing anxiety and depression. And as someone who commonly sees injured runners, I recognize a large proportion of them will struggle with, you know, feeling moody or feeling like some of their underlying mental health is taking a hit when they can't exercise. And I think there's enough to be stressed. We're continuing to live with this COVID-19 pandemic, and being able to physically be active can really have a lot of natural ways of helping the brain and the mind to cope, and for people to deal with stress relief.
So I think that's why
just as in general, we believe that physical activity is so important, and the American College of Sports Medicine recommends at least 150 minutes of moderate exercise per week, as long as there's no underlying health issues that limit ability to participate in physical activity.
Well, I want to jump in here and bring one more voice into this conversation. Joining us in the studio to talk more about running in our community is Benjamin Lipiecki, one of the organizers of the group called the Most Informal Running Group Ever, Boston. Welcome, Benjamin.
Great to be here.
Okay, Benjamin, any tips for new runners getting started in terms of especially the right gear?
The right gear is as simple as just having a good pair of shoes. Honestly, as long as you can get out that door, got a good pair of shoes on, comfortable outfit, go for that run.
Okay, and then I want to talk a little bit about motivation as well with you. I've heard a lot of my friends talk about apps or gadgets that kind of keep them going. I know Couch to 5K is one that comes to mind. I guess, do you have any advice for people that can, any advice for runners who might need a little extra motivation, get over that slump, get out there?
Well, it's one thing to have an app. Strava's always a good one. There's a good social aspect to it. I have a lot of friends on the Garmin app, but I can't speak highly enough of joining a physical running club, seeing people in person. That's the best way to motivate yourself.
Okay. And also, since you run a running group, no pun intended there, but, when you think about distance versus speed as a group, how do you handle that?
I always tell people the only person you need to run faster or farther than is yourself. So it's what you're looking for. A nice way to mix it up is to sign up for different length races. Then you have something else to train for. But honestly, whatever you feel comfortable with, if all you have in you is a mile and a half that day, then just get out there and do a mile and a half.
I want to ask a slightly more technical question for Dr. 1040, and that is, what is gait analysis, and should new runners be thinking about proper form and that kind of thing?
So it's a great question, and gait analysis is really the concept that we're trying to evaluate how someone moves, how hard they land, what their alignment looks like while they run. And we think of this as a potential way to try to help runners to be more efficient if they're healthy or if they're injured, to find ways to help them to move better. So gait evaluation and retraining is one thing we do offer as a part of our sports medicine program. And we really think of that particularly when an athlete has really struggled with injuries. Despite doing strengthening exercises, it really hasn't corrected the way they move. Benjamin and a lot of these other social teams may also incorporate aspects of working on gait through form drills and other ways to help people to move better, and with an idea of trying to prevent injuries and improve performance. And I think that's a very reasonable way to kind of incorporate better movement strategies and again to facilitate the social aspect, because oftentimes these can be done together as a group.
Benjamin, I'm going to shift back to you for the next question. What is your favorite running path or paths, if there is a couple?
Well, I have to give it up for the rivers around Boston. Running around the Muddy River it's a gorgeous park. Olmsted, you got the history right there too. But my personal favorite is along the Charles River. If you go to Nonandom Circle over by Community Rowing, you can do a nice little loop through Watertown and Waltham. You got trees on top of you. You don't have the sun. You don't have to worry about it. Lots of waterfalls and stuff. It's really nice.
Is, having that scenery, does that help bring people in, do you think?
Absolutely. One of the things we do on our Thursday night runs is pick a different spot to run every single week. And that way you get to mix it up. The variety is the spice of life. Spice of running, too.
I totally agree with you there. Okay, and that question for you too, Dr. 1040, very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I love running on the Charles as well. I also live on the South Shore, so getting into the Blue Hills and getting some of those trails in shade, especially during the summer months, can be really nice.
All right. That was Dr. Adam 1040 and Benjamin Lipiecki. He is one of the organizers of the most informal running group ever. Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Dr. 1040.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Carrie Young. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.